accession number 18577, reel 3.
Barclay Mareto 303.
I think that probably just about completed our briefing, the preparations.
So what state of mind were you in for D-Day after all these briefings and preparations?
Two states of mind, I suppose. Apprehensive to the degree that what was going to happen, how was it going to happen, how was I as an individual going to cope with it. I'm sure that those around me knew how, a lot of those around me knew how they were going to cope with it, because they'd been through it all before. And this was some comfort, because I knew I was with people I could trust. The colonel of the Staffordshire was a Colonel Edie, Lieutenant Colonel Edie. And he had a tremendous, he was very respected in his regiment. That didn't always happen. And he had a reputation as a tactician. To underline that, we landed on D-Day at 10:30 in the morning eventually. And during that part of the Normandy campaign, for the first possibly 8 weeks, Staff's Yeomanry only lost 17 tanks. And I think that says something for the colonel as a tactician and for the officers who were under him. But I'm jumping ahead, aren't I? My thoughts really were of apprehension and really, and this is what I've been trying to analyse over the last perhaps year or so. What were really were my feelings? And I've come to the conclusion, yes, I was apprehensive, and I was not curious, but I was concerned as to how I was going to face up to this, more particularly how I might face injury or death. How would I as an individual face that and cope with it?
What happened actually on D-Day Eve?
Well, we when we left our camp, we went down to New Haven in Sussex. And it was almost like a carnival atmosphere with the streets. We weren't going through big towns, we were going through small villages, and the streets were lined where there were houses or people, waving and shouting, and we were able to, it wasn't a bad day, as I remember, for weather. We were able to sit outside on top of the tank and wave back. We got to New Haven, and we loaded on the Hards at New Haven. And I think we actually boarded the landing craft tank. It was a flat-bottom boat, which took, I think, three tanks and a couple of platoons of infantry. And I think we actually sailed from there round about dusk on the 4th of June. We sailed out into the channel. As you know, the weather was a big problem, or what the weather was going to turn out to be was a big problem. In the event, the sea was extremely rough. People were seasick, and I'm sure we came back towards shore, but we did not offload. We remained on the craft, so that we were on the craft overnight of the 4th. And whether it was on the night of the 4th we were served this wonderful meal on a rough sea, which consisted of a huge dixie of pork and bean stew. And if you can imagine fatty pork and the way it made people throw up when they saw it on this rough sea. I wasn't seasick, amazingly, and I quite enjoyed the meal, but I think I was the only one. So then it must have been on the 5th then that the decision had been made that the operation was on. So we then set sail up the channel. It was quite, I mean, it must have been quite a distance from New Haven along to the other end of the channel where we were going to approach Sword Beach, which was our landing point, just to the west, I think, of Wistrom, which was a port. We were due to land at between two little villages called Luc-sur-Mer, Luc-sur-Mer, and Lyon-sur-Mer. And I think a place nearby was called Hermanville. So that's where we're aimed for. I remember then the early dawn on D-Day, when we must have been getting near to shore. And then as it became lighter, suddenly becoming aware of the tremendous number of craft in that particular area. And it would have been even more amazing if I'd been aware of the whole of the scale of the thing, remembering that we were going to one beach which may have been a big beach so far as it looked to us, but the whole of that beachhead was going to stretch for 60 miles, and that this armada stretched for 60 miles along the coast. It's an incredible and quite frightening thought when you think about it. We weren't going in until 10:30 in the morning, so there had been people in before us, way back before the hours of dawn. Those brave little people in those one-man subs who were going in to suss out the beach and to take out some of the obstacles, and the engineers who followed them to deactivate any mines which were on these tank traps and to demolish some of them. So we weren't first on the beach, we were 10:30. So the next thing I really remember is coming in towards the beach and the tremendous noise. If you're a member of a tank crew, you're used to noise. The whole of your my life, the previous five years, have been spent for much of the day inside of the tank, mainly training, obviously. But there were noisy things, dreadfully noisy. Your turret was between the driving compartment and the engine, so the engine was within inches of you, separated from you only by a very, very small gauge steel plate. So it was noisy. The noise of the tank in motion, the tank in motion was noisy. Tank tracks running over the upper rollers and round the sprockets and clanking, clanking, clanking all the time. You've got your headsets on. You've got the background mush of the wireless and the radio. You've got the voices coming over the radio. So it was tremendously noisy. And then as we approached, the bombardment was commencing from the warships further back, and the noise of the bombardment, the sound of the explosion from the boats and the shells going over made it a very, very noisy environment. But in a way, I suppose it made you feel also slightly detached, because if you're a crew member in a tank, the tank commander's got his head screwed on, got his head screwed on properly. He's not going to be looking very much out of that turret, because you're the most vulnerable person in that tank. You're subject to being hit either by the blast of something or shrapnel, etc. So you're normally only just eyes up. You've got periscopes, but periscopes are not very easy things to see through. They're small slits, and you can't, you've only got, if you can imagine looking through a slit like that to survey that coastline which you can see out here, it's just impossible. So you're in a confined space, you're cocooned, if you like. You're not like the poor old infantry soldier who's out there on his own 2 feet. He's got people with him, but as a unit, he's virtually alone. He's got to make a lot of his own decisions. Even though he's being commanded, he's got to make a lot of his own decisions. As a member of a tank crew, you're one of 5 people. That's your unit, and you're one body, as it were. You all rely on each other. And from inside this metal shell, you're looking out on the rest of it. And it's almost like something happening outside you.
So the tank commander didn't like to take the risk of going into the turret?
Oh, sorry, no, you must have misunderstood me. I'm saying a tank commander, if he's got his head screwed on, won't show too much of his body outside the top of the turret, because he's very much at risk from a lot of things, obviously. Snipers, high explosive shells, bursting, being hit by anything. So what I'm trying to say is that from inside that tank, at that point in time, the only one who can see out a great deal is the man with his head out of the turret. The rest of you are looking, the driver, the gunner. The gunner's looking through a telescope. He's got one eye on it. The wireless operator can look through his telescope. But you also got to be turning your switches from one receiving to another to get onto troop and to get onto intercom, all that sort of thing. So you're doing other things as well. So you haven't got a lot of time to look up. But when you're looking out through something, it's almost as if it's something that's happening outside you. Whereas if you're on the deck, on your own 2 feet, it must be a different thing, I think. I remember too seeing what must have been a fuel-carrying vessel being hit and going up in just one tremendous sheet of flame and a black pall of smoke. Nobody could have got out of that. I remember too, in talking between on your radio net, the commander is normally referred to as Sunray in radio telephone jargon. So your tank commander, if you're talking about it, is the Sunray. If the tank commander, if the troop leader is talking about, or if he's talking about the troop leader, he's the next Sunray, or the squadron leader is Sunray to the troops. And I can remember hearing this the voice of somebody whose tank commander had obviously been killed, coming up repeatedly saying, my Sunray has gone, what shall I do? And repeatedly saying this until he got an answer, and I suppose the answer was, well, you must get on with it. But I remember that voice because it was somebody who didn't know what to do in those circumstances, and I could feel for him, obviously. I think one thing that we weren't trained well in all our years of training, was getting down to that sort of basic. I was lucky in that I'd been to a regiment where we were taught something about tactics. We had our own stint as commanding tanks and that sort of thing. But generally, once that had finished, you weren't taught how to cope with that sort of thing. And I would have thought that was really an essential. It didn't matter in the Staff Yeomanry because they'd had to cope with it for a long while. But then there were a lot of greenhorns in that on D-Day, particularly those poor people on Omaha Beach, who couldn't have known really what they were going into.
What else do you remember going into the beaches?
Well, next thing, I suppose, is the fact there was a traffic jam. It was such an incredible operation. So much of the troops and armour had been landed. But you've got to get off the beach. There's probably only one way off the beach. We had a beach marshal. I think it was the OC HQ squadron. But he got us off the beach. Now, I don't know what the time scale was, how long it was before we got off that beach, and when we actually got up, approaching where we needed to go to. Our house was spotted very quickly, so we knew we got the right landmark. But then when we got up to the land there, to the fields and the surrounding countryside, the field which we were supposed to cross had been mined, so we then had to find another way round. We didn't appear to be meeting ourselves at that stage any real opposition. The opposition may have been scared off by the bombardments. Somebody else may have got there first. Or maybe, because there was a bigger area mined than we were aware of, they weren't concentrating so much on that particular tiny bit. So we had to find our way around. We needed to go into a road, so we had to make a detour. And we crossed the open country adjacent to this minefield. And it was then that we saw some stragglers of prisoners of war. There was no way we could stop and deal with them. And they just wandered on through. They looked jolly relieved to be going in the direction they were going with their hands up. I don't think they were very high quality troops. Further in, we were signalled to by a German who wanted to surrender. And to this day and age, I don't know why we did it, but we stopped. We didn't know what to do with him. There were no ground troops with us to whom we could hand him over. We weren't prepared just to let him wander in case he did any damage to anybody further back. So we got two options. We could have finished him off, or we could, in the event we put him in our turret. That tends to amaze me now.
How did he react to that?
He did as he was told, because I got my pistol on him. He sat on the floor, but he could have caused a lot. If he'd been a kamikaze warrior, he could have caused a lot of damage, perhaps.
Did he seem scared at the thought of going in the turret of a shaman?
I don't think so. Probably because he was relieved that he hadn't been shot. We got rid of him very quickly, though. We offloaded him some inventory when we came across them.
What should you have done with him?
I don't know what we should have done with him. I suppose the most sensible thing would have been to let him wander back and surrender, always assuming he would have done so. But I don't know. I don't know. You do what you do at that point in time. Perhaps more in instinct than by thought.
So you're pushing inland from Sword Beach on the 6th of June?
Yeah.
You haven't said, actually, what happened when the tank went into the sea.
Well, I got my feet wet on the 6th of June 1994, to a greater degree than I did on the 6th of June 1944. We were on Arrowmarsh Beach for the 50th anniversary commemorations.
But what happened in 1994? When you went ashore?
Well, we went ashore and we did it successfully. We landed in shallow water because at 10:30, remember, the early people had gone in much earlier in the morning, 6 o'clock, perhaps or maybe earlier, when the tide was high. If we'd have gone in when tide was high, we'd have landed much further out. We'd have been in deep water. We'd have been in risk of perhaps our exhaust stack going underneath, or the driver would have been sealed in with his hatch down. But you could have gone into deeper water and your tank would have been drowned and you had a problem getting out. But we didn't. That didn't happen. The tide was low when we got to the beach. So we landed in shallow water on a good beach. So we had no problem in getting on shore at all.
Was any enemy fire hitting the tank or coming near it?
If it had, I wouldn't have been aware of it. If it was small fire, you wouldn't have noticed it. Had it been a direct hit, you would have noticed it. But even with a thing, like, even if when you, subsequently in later days, when we perhaps hit a mine and we lost a track or shed a track, you may not even been terribly aware of that happening, because a tank is a tremendously noisy thing, and you've got the other noise of battle going on around you. If you've actually been hit by an armour-piercing shell, yes, you would know it.
So, what happened on the rest of the 6th of June to you as you were pushing in?
Well, do you want an amusing story? Because the next story was a bit ludicrous. The fields of Normandy are divided by hedges, which are called the bocage, and very good for sheltering infantry, or they're good for you if you want to shelter behind it and just peer over the top. A tank to engage normally needs to be safely, that it must be not in open and open country, and it's got to be hull down, because it's a sitting target for anything if it's above the horizon. But we saw some movement in the bocage on our left-hand side, and we guessed it was a platoon of infantry, so we shot at them with machine gun fire. There seemed to be some movement still there, but no response. So we edged over to look over the hedge, and what we'd done was to hit some poor old French cow, which was in agony. And again, another ludicrous thing in what was normally be the heat of battle. We felt we couldn't leave this wretched animal in its agony. So we tried to depress the gun to put it out of its misery. But we were too close to it. You can only when you fully depress the gun of a tank, it was still above this poor animal. So I took the breech block out, which is a heavy thing, and we sighted this poor animal down the barrel of the gun to put it out of its misery. And then we're off again. We didn't meet any resistance further on until we managed to get to the road, which was our objective. Caen was our objective on D-Day. And there were several roads into Caen, but the one we were aiming for was south of a place called Lebesey Wood, I believe. Between us and the road was a huge tank trap. And I was speaking to my gunner a few weeks ago, and he reminded me of this particular episode, that we didn't think we were going to be able to get down and up this tank ditch, because a tank ditch, you're going down nose first, and you've got to have enough grip and enough space to climb up the other side. And if you can't, your tank slides down and you've had it. You're completely out of action. In the event, we did in fact tackle this and got down the other side. I think the gun nearly broke his neck when he went back against his headrest when we hit the deck. But that was a major obstacle, but we were on the road. There were a few soldiers, I think it was the Cosley, the King's Own Shropshire Light Infantry, I think so. Who were with us, and I think we took some of them on the back of our tank along this road. I think training is significant. I mentioned to you about the paratroop training, which instilled confidence into you. The infantryman is trained to live in the environment in which he's going to be placed. And for those infantrymen to get up and ride on the back of our tank was as much as they could mentally prepare themselves to do, because they hated it. They didn't feel safe. Whereas we as a tank crew, at least I as a tank crew, felt much safer in the environment I was fighting in than I would have been on the ground. So they weren't very happy, and they got off with great relief when we stopped. By this time, though, we were on our own. I was trying to think this morning where the rest of the troop were. They certainly weren't with us. And our nearest contacts were two other troops in the squadron to our right. When we landed, we were the easternmost edge of the whole of the British Army second sector. The Canadians were to our right, and apart from us, there was only the 6th Airborne Division to our left. We were on the western edge of the River Orne and the canal, and the 6th Airborne were on the other side of the canal. This is very near the famous Pegasus Bridge. And that's the area we were in. But we were on our tod at that time. There were a few infantry lying ahead of us on the road, dead, and in front of, further up to the top of the road, and beyond which you couldn't see, there was a slight bend in the road. There was a bridge over the road with an archway, and I think it was probably the railway line which led through that area round into Caen. And there was activity there. But what was behind that bridge or beyond it? By going ahead on our own, we would have been completely exposed without support, and giving, if we were eliminated, free way for somebody else to come from that direction down and be cause more trouble to our people. So our instructions were to hang on there. The other people weren't quite so lucky. We didn't know it at that time, and I didn't realise it until reading some things, histories recently, that as luck would have it, bad luck would have it, probably, there was a unit of the 22nd Panzer Division which was training in that area at that time, and so they were being easily moved across to where we were. Now, bear in mind, this is later in the day. It must have been getting on, it must have been in the afternoon then, perhaps late afternoon. But several of our tanks from other troops were destroyed then by this unit, and they were slightly to our right. They'd also been obstructed by an anti-tank ditch. I suspect that there are anti-tank ditches on both sides of this road and in the woods to either side of it. But two other troop leaders were killed just at that point in time. And that was as far as we got on D-Day, because I think light had started to fall then. And the next thing I remember is...